From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
This is Digital Campus, episode 73, recorded on September the 1st, 2011. Farewell, Steve Jobs.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of Digital Campus from the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University. I'm Mills Kelly, your host today, and with me are our regulars on our back-to-school edition, Tom Scheinfeld of foundhistory.org. Tom, how's it going up there in New England?
It's going well. I finally have power on after three-plus days of outage because of Irene. So I'm speaking to you from my home, not from some
Starbucks or,
yeah, improvised
or community
location.
Shelter.
Yeah, exactly, that I've been doing the last few days.
You know, I have to be the only person on the East Coast who was unhappy that his power didn't go out, because we had our house wired for a generator this past year because our power goes out all the time. And I had my generator all set up and ready to go, and my power never even blinked.
That's the way.
So, I could come over to your house, Mills, and just cut your cords if you'd like.
Okay, that'd be good. That'd be good. So, I live in Bethesda, so... and that other voice you hear on the line here is Dan Cohen from dancohen.org. Dan, did you lose power?
No, blinked a little bit, but it's good. Ever since I moved from Maryland to Virginia, I've had no problems with power. I used to go out all the time in Silver Spring, Maryland.
Well, I'm very happy for you.
Yeah.
But it meant you could just keep working and getting ready for the new semester. And
I got an extra 100 emails out during the storm.
There you go. See, that's important. And finally, we have Amanda French from AmandaFrench.net. Amanda, you're out of upstate New York and here in Virginia, so you survived the storm.
I did survive the storm. I was supposed to go down to Charlottesville that weekend for a party to get together with some friends, and I decided not to go to that. So my social life suffered a little bit, but power didn't even blink where I was in downtown D.C., so.
Well, that's good. That's good. So Digital Campus survived the storm. I know everyone will be happy to know. But one question of survival that came up between our last podcast and now is the question of what's going to happen with the Apple Corporation now that Steve Jobs is stepping down, seemingly for good this time. Dan, what's your take on this?
I know probably by the time everyone listens to this podcast, it's kind of been a horse that's been... rather beaten by this point. I think the kind of obvious points are, obviously he's probably rather ill, and that's sad, and we wish him well. I think most of the coverage has been about his incredible run as CEO and what made him so brilliant. Of course, if you read all of the articles in the tech press, you the takeaway would be that you should be a micromanager, that you should get angry at people all the time. You should be a perfectionist. What else? What are the other keys to his success?
Take calligraphy.
Oh, yes, drop out of college, but only take one calligraphy class. So, I think it's sort of these pieces that have really focused on, how could you be Steve Jobs? Don't really make sense. I think, he really has a unique perspective. I think, from some people's perspective, he was sort of a fascist. I shouldn't speak about him in the past tense, but in his role as CEO, right? Yeah, and then on the flip side, some people thought he was an auteur. That level of control, led to lots of great things. And I think obviously the truth is somewhere in between. I think what's interesting for people listening to this podcast is not any lessons of how we can be better CEOs or managers, but really, the role of Apple in the education market. And, when I heard the news about Steve Jobs, I went, since I'm a historian, I went to the Stanford Historical Archives of the Apple Corporation or Apple Inc., Apple Computer as it was back when they were cataloging these documents. And we'll link to it from the show notes, but there's a really terrific archive of documents from early Apple from the late 70s, early 80s, a lot of which have to do with the origins of the Macintosh. And they've got some incredible early video, actually, of Steve Jobs. He looks like one of my freshmen this semester. I mean, he looks so young in these videos. And one of the things that struck me is how much he got the education market as a kind of critical place for the Mac early on. You know, I think part of this was forced on Apple in that when, you know, IBM released its PC and set up a kind of standard for PC compatibles, it very quickly took over the business market. And if you look at the marketing materials from the early 80s for the Macintosh, they really saw that there was this opening in education where if they focused on that, they could get students and teachers early on. And of course, I think it has been true. I don't think it's bluster that Steve Jobs has always been interested, not necessarily in the technology, but the intersection of the liberal arts and technology. That whatever that, you know, brief time at Reed, and probably even before that, he had interests that were much more broad than, let's say, Woz, right? Wozniak, who was much more of a technician, and that he wanted to see how computers can be, as he called it, a bicycle for the mind, or a way to kind of enhance what you normally do as, let's say, an artist or an architect, and how the Mac could help that out. So as Amanda pointed out, I mean, this fact that he took calligraphy actually did come into play, that he learned a lot about fonts and the differences between them, and that he wanted the Macintosh to have from the get-go, rather than monospaced computerish kinds of fonts that you saw on other computers, he wanted them to look like high quality print materials. And I think that had a permanent effect on computing in general, but really it had it on education. And, you know, as I think we all know, in the 80s, Apple really took over both higher ed and K-12 markets, usually well over 50%, until the kind of cheap PCs took over those markets in the 90s. And then, of course, it swung back as Steve came back to Apple and started producing machines that that were just, you know, really beautiful, and that students started picking up again, just, I think, as part of the consumer market. You know, I think what's been lost is that you don't really think about Apple now as, you know, the education computer company, which is what everyone thought of in, let's say, 1986. I think it's now become a computer device manufacturer. I think the name change reflects that from a few years ago when it changed from, after the iPhone came out, from Apple Computer to just Apple Inc. But it has that legacy. And I think, just, you know, for people listening to this podcast, I think it's interesting to think about the long history of Apple and really the critical role that the education market made in making the Mac what it was.
Well, and I would also say that just the transformation of Apple from a computer and software manufacturing firm to a media company, and kind of blurring all these boundaries between what kind of are access points, like the computer or the smartphone, and but also then the content itself, and becoming a content provider, and really challenging the way that companies in that industry think about where they sit in the market. But I think that's also really been useful in education, because we do a lot of that blurring. You know, we're increasingly working on interdisciplinary kinds of approaches. We encourage our students to play with media in all sorts of different ways. And so so Apple's sort of their corporate structure, I think, has provided some inspiration.
Yeah. And I should just say, as a gloss on that introduction to Jobs, you know, he was not solely responsible for this. And I think that's been lost a little bit as everyone lionizes the man. But, you know, in particular, the very brilliant Jeff Raskin was a real motivating force behind this vision of a device that was for, as he called it, the person in the street. You know, not for computer hobbyists, which, if you remember back in the late 70s, I mean, the Altair and those kinds of machines really were for computer hobbyists. And even the Apple II, When you open the original Apple II manual, and I pulled one out off the shelves, and you look at it, it really is, you know, the first few paragraphs are about, you know, you should really learn programming to use this device. But the Mac was really set up to be a computer for everybody else, and part of everybody else is, you know, these other interests that people have, and to make the computer disappear. And I think that's something really interesting to think about, the way that the whole Macintosh team really, you know, yes, with Jobs as a kind of, you know, motivating force, but lots of people thinking about it as a kind of truly general purpose device.
I'll even mention that the very first time I used a computer was when I was, believe it or not, a senior in college. And my college had a Mac lab. They had a computer lab with Macs in it. I had written my undergraduate thesis on a Smith Corona electronic typewriter that held 4.5 pages of text, at which point you had to print it out. That's how much memory it had. And I had heard all of these things about how the computers were great and they were pretty easy and you could, you know, put your whole paper in there and print it out. And so for my undergraduate thesis, I went and figured out how to use the Apple computers in the lab in college. So what you said, Dan, about the Apple, you know, Steve Jobs really getting the importance of education for the computer and vice versa, I think is really true.
I'll just say that I think, Dan, that your take on this is exactly right. I mean, in some respects, I've been disappointed in the, you know, what I've been reading, because it is all about Jobs's management style, and I think you're absolutely right that part of the story doesn't. I mean, it just kind of doesn't pertain to the kinds of things that we do in education. I mean, I think the way that Google operates, or even the way, frankly, that Microsoft operates, is, you know, there are more lessons there for, you know, digital humanities and project management in the humanities and in education, and for the way the university runs than Apple. I mean, Apple was, in some ways, Apple's a unique case, even in business, but certainly in it just doesn't apply. So, like, a lot of what I've been reading just hasn't rung true. I think this other story about Apple as a provider to students and faculty, that's the more interesting story for us, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, Steve, we will miss you and wish you well. And, you know, we're all sad that it's very clear that, you know, health is the main reason behind this, but so it's sort of an era coming to a close in that sense, and I think that's one of the reasons that so many people have had so much to say about this this particular story. So we'll see what happens with Apple next. In our continuing coverage of scanning of books and the copyright of scanning of books, and is this legal and is it not legal, the latest salvo in this long war has come from the University of Michigan, which has announced that it will now begin providing scanned copies of orphan books, those which no one can determine the copyright holder or get in touch with the copyright holder anymore. And so they're going to start making these available online, which is, sounds a little bit like Google Books. But Amanda, what's your take on this? You follow this end of the world more closely than some of us do.
I do. So the University of Michigan actually announced that it was going to do this back in June, and it's recently what has happened is that a number of universities have followed its lead. The University of Michigan libraries, you know, led by Paul Courant, I mean, they're just so brave. I really love them so much in this area. So essentially, University of Michigan is also heavily involved with HathiTrust. They have been they've had an orphan works project in the works for quite a while, where they say, okay, we have all of these scans of books, some enormous percentage of them, some estimates say about 50% are orphan works, meaning that the copyright status of them is unclear. that you don't know, you can't find the copyright holders in order to ask permission to put that book online. So you're just stuck. They're not public domain. They're not something that's really recent where you can write somebody and ask for permission to put this digital copy online. They're orphan works. So I was just so pleased when I heard back in June that the University of Michigan says, look, we're going to do a lot of investigation, identify whether works are orphaned or not. And the only way to do that is to see if we can find the copyright holder. If we can't, we're going to identify that as an orphan work. And University of Michigan says, we're going to put these online for our own community. So they're not actually putting it online publicly. The analogy that I've seen in a couple of places is they say, well, it's just like the library itself. You have to, you know, be a member of the University of Michigan in order to check out a physical book. Some libraries even restrict whether you can get into the library. You know, sometimes you have to have an ID or you have to sign up for a guest registry or something like that. So they're not, you know, these are not publicly available to everyone. They're only publicly available to the university communities. And then what has happened recently is that a number of universities, mostly those who are already part of the HathiTrust Consortium, have said that they're going to do the same thing. So University of California Libraries, which is an enormous system, Cornell, also a great activist in the copyright arena, Duke, Emory, Johns Hopkins Libraries, all of these places are going to follow Michigan's lead, which I think is just fantastic, because I feel like fair use is a little bit, you know, it's likely to erode if you don't use it. It's something that is going to get rusty if you're not careful. So I'm very glad that people are being brave and saying, we're going to take the risk, which to my mind is probably not that great a risk, of being sued by somebody who doesn't want their work online. I think it's just fabulous. I think it's a great idea.
See, Amanda, I think that's a really good point about fair use, because, I mean, anybody who's been a regular listener to the podcast knows that I'm pretty aggressive on making things available without violating somebody's copyright and taking away somebody's right to make money off of their work. But I do think that fair use is often held up as a really big club, or copyright law is held up as a really big club, and to scare libraries and cultural organizations, universities, away from making reasonable use of works. And so I think that Michigan's approach is actually a very good one. I'm very supportive of it. If I were a publisher, I'd be probably a little more freaked out, because it seems maybe that it's a real slippery slope from making it only available to Michigan library patrons to then all of a sudden the whole public having access. Tom, Dan, you have a take on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, we've been advocates, and I think these heads of these libraries are pretty gutsy. John Wilkin, in particular at Michigan, who's been spearheading this, I think are right to, you know, push the bounds of fair use. They bought these books, they had them scanned, and they're not making them available to the general public, they're making them available to the scholarly community. I think they're a really tough target to sue, to be honest.
Well, who's going to sue them if nobody can get in touch with the copyright holder?
Well, I've heard rumors that, you know, there are lawyers out there who would love the 30% fee on a successful suit, and I'm sure they could find, you know, one person out there who's got a book that's been scanned in Michigan. But, you know, look, the fair use provision here seems so clear that it's for non-commercial use. It's not hurting a market because there's no market for the book. I mean, there's all these things that you could check off. The one piece of the fair use provisions that seem tricky are that it's the whole book. You know, it's not 10%, although that this number that always comes up is written into no law. It's the whole book rather than a part of the book. And so, you know, on one of the four fair use provisions that you normally hear about, it seems like it's pushing the boundaries. But again, I think they're right to do it. And, you know, I think the tricky part is, what does this do to the Google settlement? Because now all of a sudden, you know, orphan books really were at the core of you know, why the Google Book settlement kind of fell apart, because there didn't seem to be anyone representing the Orphan Works holders in the room. And so now you've got universities making millions of these books available, or at least soon they'll be making them available to students, faculty, and staff at these institutions. And then what does that say about the ongoing lawsuit, which it seems like is still falling apart, that they're not going to come up with something to kind of solve all the issues. So I think it makes it for a very complex environment, but I think that these heads of these libraries are right to do it.
Tom?
I think it'd be interesting to see, and maybe one of our listeners or maybe one of you guys knows this, where this term Orphan Works came from, and when it was coined, and who coined it, because it's become this, it's become reified in the discourse, I think, in a way that it's not in the law. I mean, there's nothing in the copyright law that talks about orphan works, as far as I'm concerned. They're this category of things that that copyright law actually doesn't deal very well with. But I think we've made a mistake in a way, and I don't know if we could have avoided it, but there was in taking this term and turning it into something more than just a descriptive term for a certain set of materials, we've almost created a separate category of intellectual property. I think it's actually gotten in our way. I think it would have been better if along the line we hadn't kind of reified orphan works as this thing that we have to be careful of. If we had just sort of done what Michigan and these institutions are doing now, if we had done that all along, and just had asserted kind of fair use and had seen what, or even not fair use, just sort of used them and see what had, you know, try to see what happened. I mean, I think as soon as they became orphan works, then they became a problem. Looking backwards, this is hindsight, but I wonder if, you know, several years ago, if we had just, you know, not kind of countenanced this debate over these materials, if we had just kind of gone ahead and see what happened, if we wouldn't be kind of stuck where we are today. I think I guess what I'm saying is, I think we let the copyright holders, the big copyright, I think we let them frame the debate by creating this category of orphan works that we had to be very, very careful about.
We actually, when you brought this point up yesterday, Tom, we were all kind of doing a little research trying to figure out the origin of this term, which was actually a quite interesting question. The best source I found for looking it up was the Google News Archive, at least in just some, you know, cursory research. And it looks to me like the term was coined in 2005. That was the earliest mention I could find of it, which does make me think that it might have been related to the Google Books project there. You know, perhaps it was, perhaps it was coined in the protest by the Authors Guild. Who knows? But I'm not sure I agree that the term itself is a problem. I think that for me, the problem actually goes back to 1976, when they all of a sudden changed copyright from something that had to be registered and that there were records about who the copyright holders were, to something that was automatic. And granted, they did that in order to bring copyright law in line with what they were doing in Europe and so on. But I mean, it just means that now you there's nowhere to look it up. There is no database of who owns copyright for what, for not even for current copyright holders, really. I mean, there's some sort of ad hoc things that people have done on their own to try to figure this sort of thing out. But, you know, I mean, it's sort of as though they passed a federal law saying that, okay, everybody automatically has a driver's license now when they turn 16. And I don't know, trying to figure out who didn't have a driver's license before that law went into effect is not efficient.
Yeah, just be glad we're not dealing with this in the East Central European context, because the publishing house that I've dealt with a little bit in Prague was 1938 was owned by a Jewish family, and so was Aryanized in 1939 by the Nazi administration, and then sold after the end of the war to another publishing concern, which was then nationalized by the communists in 1948, and then then just closed at some point by the communist government. And so there are all these books that they published, and so who's the copyright holder on that? And because the Jewish owners, well, they perished, and their heirs also perished, and so they're gone, and many of the authors perished, and so that's just an impossible situation to try to sort out. I was listening to you all talk, I was thinking, you know, I'm 52 years old. I'm planning to retire sometime around age 65, and I've got at least $10 that says the Google suit will still be going on. So this one just may never, or may take, you know, an act of Congress to resolve it. Who knows?
13 years from now, 2025.
Right. Okay.
I just look back through my blog, and my first post on this topic was November 28th, 2005.
Okay.
So when the term became popular somehow.
I had forgotten it was still Google Print then.
Yeah.
Oh, what a mess.
Yeah. I just hate that we're playing the game on copyright's turf. You know, we should be doing, and I think activists, you know, moves like this one, what they do is they try to bring the battle back to what I would call our turf. And I think that's smart. You know, if we let them set the rules of the game, I think we're just bound to lose.
I do definitely agree with you in the sense that I think that it's almost as though libraries got told all of a sudden you have to ask permission, whereas before there wasn't any notion that you had to ask permission, and we all sort of, you know, said, oh, okay, oh yes, well we have to ask permission, and then orphan works became this term of like, well, but we don't know who to ask permission for these works. When the whole question for me is like, no, you shouldn't even have to ask permission for some of this stuff. You know, you should just go do it. I don't know. Yeah. Particularly, you know, if you own a copy of the book and you scan it, or you, you know, acquire the right to the scan, why can't you put up a scan for your readers, you know, for your community of that book that you own? I mean, it's really related to this GSU e-reserves case as well. If the library owns a copy of a journal in physical format and they make a copy, they themselves make a digital copy, or a faculty member makes a digital copy of that, how is it copyright infringement to put a copy of that up for the people who have the right to read that physical book? It just seems like I know that the law kind of makes it copyright infringement in many cases, but it just doesn't seem logical. We own the physical copy of the book. People can read it physically. We just want to make it a little more convenient for the people who have the right to read that book physically, or journal physically, to read it online. You know, what's wrong with that? What's so wrong with that?
You know, there you go. And, you know, I will quote an unnamed member of the Supreme Court, current Supreme Court of the United States, who in a speech recently to a group of law school students said, if it's wrong, it's wrong.
If it's wrong, it's wrong.
So, what he was referring to is, if a law is wrong, it's wrong. It needs to be corrected. Just because there's a precedent involved doesn't, you know, we have 100 years of precedent on it, doesn't mean it's right. If it's wrong, it's wrong. So, you know, I think we need to make a pledge to our listeners that in our next podcast, we will actually not say the word Google once. And just see if we can actually do it. I'm not sure that we can, but it's worth a try. But having said that, I now need to bring up Google again, and that is that a recent study by, and I think this was probably a shocker to all of us who work in higher education, a recent study by a group of librarians in Illinois indicates that today's college students are really bad at finding information online. This, of course, was a complete shock to me, and I'm sure to all of us here at Digital Campus, and probably all of our listeners as well. And they studied students' use of such things as Google to try to find information, and found that they just weren't any good at it. Obviously, I'm being very snarky and sarcastic about this because it's something I've been writing about for years. Here's what bugged me about that story. Let's blame the students. They're yeah. bad at this.
Yeah.
Those dorks, you know, what's wrong with them? And as opposed to, why is it that our students aren't any good at finding information using these very sophisticated tools that lots of very expensive companies have made available to them for very good reasons? And the reason is that we don't, in my view anyway, and I'll get on my soapbox for just a minute, is because we don't teach them to do it.
Right.
It's also because those tools are inherently difficult to use. The information environment is inherently complex. It's like, I agree with you, Mills. It's like blaming students for saying, oh, they can't program when they have, you know, if they haven't taken any classes on programming or coding or whatever. You know, of course they can't. That's a very difficult thing. It's a thing that takes skill. And, you know, most of the quote unquote information literacy education that students get it's literally like an hour in their composition class. That's the kind of education we give them on how to do research. And that's insufficient because it's very hard. It's very complicated.
You know, I'm teaching a new undergrad class in the history department on digital history. And we've got about 40 students, and I sort of got a lay of the land in the first class a couple of days ago. And, you know, I think that I think in some sense, some of these skills have sort of atrophied, just to bring us full circle back to the Apple II and Steve Jobs and the early Mac. But, you know, a lot of the computing environment has been hidden from students for a long time. The freshman class this year has never known a world without the iPod. In fact, they don't remember Napster. it's just a new world where they really have come into a kind of seamless digital environment with devices that just work, and they never learn HTML or programming or anything like that by tinkering or hacking. And I think it will atrophy more. I mean, I think something like Facebook, for instance, well, you don't have to set up a blog. You've got your Facebook site, you know, and it's a walled garden that just works, and they can share photos, and they don't have to learn about what it is. I think this, we have to get used. I think, Mills, you're absolutely right that in order to do, you know, to have students who understand the stuff better, we actually have to teach the stuff. I mean, it's not there in the environment as it was, you know, 25 years ago. When you bumped into a computer, it booted into the command line and you had to learn how to like see a directory and what a file was and things like that. So, I do worry about this and what the basic education, where it happens.
Yeah, this is why I wish the syllabus finder still worked, because I would love to pull a whole bunch of syllabi and see how many freshman syllabi around the United States taught some basic information literacy skills as part of the course.
I bet
the number is very, very low, because
right.
I think we make, as faculty members, we make the assumption that because our students their fingers can fly across the keys on their laptop keyboards, that that they're actually in some way, you know, they're adept users of that box, but they're not adept learners with it. And that's the thing I think we're really going to have to grapple with over the next, you know, 5 to 7 years, that we have to teach our students to use these tools, because as Amanda said, you know, other than just a basic keyword search, it's hard to do. And the resources are incredible, and I think we're kind of falling down on the job, and that Illinois study is evidence of that. And I get a little, as our listeners know, I get
well,
a little.
It's one, I mean, just as you said, Mills, this is so not news. I actually loved that this story did get picked up by a whole lot of tech blogs and was kind of fairly widely reported on in the media, but this is so not news to basically anyone who's ever tried to teach any kind of research. It's not news to librarians. This is very well covered territory, very well studied territory. I mean, the other thing we haven't mentioned is interface design. The thing is that Google is very easy to use and to get pretty good results from. The information landscape that we're asking college students to explore is much, much more complex than the kinds of things Google indexes, even given that Google is doing books and scholarly articles and patents and all kinds of things. I mean, if you are a chemistry student, you need to learn to use particular databases that allow you to look up chemical structures. And there are different kinds of databases. They're going to take different inputs. They're going to require different search string construction skills. And most of these things are very decontextualizing too, because they're all just kind of, they all just fit in your browser window. You don't know what the heck the thing is that you're searching. I mean, when I teach research skills, and I was lucky enough to get to teach a whole semester long course on advanced academic research skills at North Carolina State, and I taught it 3 times, and it was a great class, and I loved getting the chance to really delve into this. But when I taught it, like, one of the things we would do is to say, okay, there is such a thing as an academic journal. Here's a print bound copy of an academic journal. Let's pass it around and look at it. Ooh. Why is there such a thing as a journal? You know, which databases are indexing these things? Which ones also index books? Why are there such things as academic books? You know, what the heck, how many academic journals or things does this particular database index? You can't tell that. Like, some databases have a very small scope. You know, they're only indexing a few things. Some are really enormous and have tens of thousands of records. And you can't tell that in the digital realm. You can tell that if you're holding a very thick book versus a very thin book, but you can't tell that in database. I don't know. It just goes on and on and on.
Yeah. I think this is a topic we're going to return to again and again. Is what are the best ways to help our students acquire the kinds of skills that they need to be successful in, as you say, Amanda, this really complex and varied information environment? Because, I mean, it's hard for us as scholars to negotiate this landscape, and so of course it's hard for our students too, and so I think it's no surprise that they default to the easy keyword search in a browser and see what comes up. So, as I say, this is a topic I think we'll be back at more and more. So thanks, everybody. We're going to sign off at this point because several of us have to go and teach classes, believe it or not. And so thanks again for listening to Digital Campus. Dan, Tom, Amanda, thanks for your participation.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do.